brightest students to the profession. If you ever wanted to be a teacher, the time is now. Amazing things are happening in teaching today. Find out more at teach.org.
90.1 KPFT Houston.
That hypnotic beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals it is 8 p.m. on Thursday, and time once again for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling. This is Greg Audell on 90.1 KPFT, Houston's community radio, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Along with the absolute best team on radio, I am thrilled to bring you storytellers who range in age from 10 to 100 and from all walks of life. During this very strange year, we all owe a tremendous amount to the frontline healers who have risked their own lives to care for others. This includes doctors, nurses, custodial staff, and so many others who we'll never get to meet. But tonight, we're going to feature two such healers who were our guests before most of us had ever heard of COVID or could even imagine a worldwide pandemic becoming our reality. Dr. Barry Rose was Warren Holloman's guest on October 27th, 2016, while Dr. Michael Schaefer was my guest on March 22nd, 2017.
We believe that every day of every life is a story worth telling, and we believe that every good story has the power to infuse our lives with meaning and purpose, potentially leading to other important things, things like happiness and healing. Now, if you are at all perplexed by this equation about how stories create meaning and how that creates happiness and healing, you won't be after my guest storyteller, Dr. Barry Rose, portrays the doctor-patient relationship as oftentimes the most powerful formula for healing. Dr. Rose is an orthopedic surgeon from San Francisco. He's chief of surgery for one of the largest multi-specialty medical groups in California. He's also recently published a book, The Cutting Edge of Compassion, How Physicians, Health Professionals, and Patients Can Build Healing Relationships Based on Trust. Dr. Barry Rose, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Warren, it's great to be here, and it's wonderful to check in and see you again. It's been a year since we've seen each other, and I'm just glad to be able to be on your show and visit with you.
I'm delighted this has happened. I believe we were comparing notes. We think we met 6 years ago.
Yes.
At a writer's conference, and I can say that we both were aspiring writers, and you have actually now published your book. But I have to ask, what took you so long?
Well, I originally wrote the book in third person, so it had a lot of facts. There were some stories,
yeah,
but a lot of facts. Yeah. And then after the writer's conference we went to, we all critiqued each other's work, and we had writers critique our work.
You critiqued me, I critiqued you.
And it sounded like after that most people wanted the stories instead of the facts,
the
and
data.
The third person, the data stuff. And when I went back and reread what I wrote, I almost fell asleep, so I thought, well, I better rewrite this thing.
Well, I've read it. It just came out last month, and it's wonderful. It's really your own personal memoir of being a physician, starting as a child all the way up to the present. It's rare that a doctor reflects on an emotional and sort of a spiritual level like that, and I loved reading it. Thank you for writing that book.
You bet.
And in I'll say that in the book you convey many poignant narratives, but, you know, the one that struck me most and the one I'd like you to share with our listeners is the incident that occurred during your fourth year of medical school. And as I recall, you were doing a rotation in cardiovascular surgery. You were trying to figure out what you wanted to do with the rest of your life. And it was at that point you signed up for this rotation with this probably very famous, at least in his own mind, cardiovascular surgeon. And I guess to set up the story, could you just take a moment and tell us a little bit about the reputation and personality of the surgeon?
Well, he was a big-name heart surgeon, and I thought I either wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon or a cardiologist at the time. And he was the chief of cardiothoracic surgery, and most people called him Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, because outside of the operating room, he was a very sweet, nice, diplomatic guy. Yeah. Inside the operating room, he was a raving maniac and would throw instruments, and he had good technical skills, but he treated everybody in the operating room, staff, students, with anger, abuse, and it was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Most of the time when you were in surgeries with him.
Just this old school surgeon who thought it was normal to be abusive.
Yeah, the pressure was unbelievable many times.
So, ironically, as life can be, while you were working for this man with this personality, this temperament, something amazing happened, one of the most powerful experiences of your life.
Absolutely.
And I guess with that background in mind, would you tell us your story?
I would be happy to. I learned a lot on that rotation about the incredible power of compassion from, quote, Dr. B. During one particular heart surgery, I was faced with an unforgettable life and death situation. I was assisting Dr. B on a bypass surgery when the patient that we were operating on, as we were getting ready to close the chest, went into cardiac arrest. The chest was nearly closed when it happened, and Dr. B had just scrubbed out and was in the scrub room just outside our operating room. When he was notified, he walked back into the room in a dramatic fashion without donning gloves or gown, and he went straight to the patient to reopen the chest, pulling out the stitches and cutting the sternal wires barehanded, and had me then give the patient open heart massage. Then he scrubbed back in, and he shocked the heart multiple times with small intraoperative shock paddles to try to resume a heartbeat. Nothing worked. After 5 to 10 minutes of this, he looked at me, his inexperienced fourth-year medical student, and told me to scrub out and go tell the family the patient wasn't going to make it. The patient was a mayor of a small local town, and his two sons were deans of different departments at the University of Kansas, which was my alma mater and also the medical school I was attending. Knowing the patient and his family were influential, well-educated people didn't make the task any easier. So I scrubbed out and I began walking down the dimly lit corridor towards the waiting room in my sweat-soaked scrub top. I was literally trembling. My own heart was just about coming out of my chest as I thought about my grave responsibility of what I had to tell this family. I emerged from this dark hallway into the brightly lit waiting room to tell this wonderful family the bad news. As I told them what was happening, their faces drained of color, and they went into a state of shock and disbelief, which resulted in the wife, sons, and myself breaking down into tears. It was one of the most overwhelming moments of my life. I felt totally helpless, and after regaining some composure, I left and re-entered the operating room. As I walked in, Dr. B was scrubbed out and was sitting in the scrub area, and the patient's condition had not changed. Dr. B had placed the patient on something called a balloon pump to help augment blood pressure, but all attempts were failing. He told me the patient wasn't going to make it and scrub back in and close the chest. Dr. B left the room, sat down on a stool, and put his head in his hands in defeat. As I was preparing to close the chest, even though my hands were shaking, I grabbed the wire for the sternum. Before I started to rewire the sternum, the anesthesiologist looked at me and said, "Hey, Dr. B's in the scrub area. Why not shock the heart again?" I figured, what did we have to lose? I shocked the heart one more time with the intraoperative paddles, and miraculously, the heart started beating again. The anesthesiologist and I spent at least a full minute looking at the monitor watching the heartbeat. It was probably the longest minute of my life. When we finally got over the disbelief, I went out to the scrub area and asked Dr. B to please come back into the room. He was in shock as he also watched the monitor, and then he said, "Oh no, it's just the balloon pump. Turn the pump off." We did, and yet the heart continued to beat. He quickly scrubbed back in, and once he re-entered the room again, he instructed me to go out, scrub out, and tell the family that the patient might live now. I had already been faced with sharing the news of this poor man's probable untimely death, and now I was charged with breaking the news, different news, to the family. Again, I walked down that dimly lit corridor into the bright waiting room. When the family saw me through the door, they rushed to me for any news, and this time I was able to give them some hope for survival. The family embraced me tearfully, and together we experienced this roller coaster of emotion. Compassion, sadness, hope, anger, frustration, and the fear of facing the unknown. That difficult month with Dr. B gave me one of the greatest gifts of my training. I learned about compassion and the importance of never giving up, the power of positive energy, and the disruption of negative energy. Those lessons helped me shape my approach with patients in difficult or stressful situations to this day. So much about patient care has to do with coupling knowledge with and approaching patients from a place of compassionate care, love, and positive energy. This approach positively affects the ultimate result, which should be the best possible healing for our patients. When I graduated from medical school, we had our own private graduation ceremony. We were also included in the University of Kansas commencement ceremony for the entire university. That ceremony included walking downhill into the football stadium. Along the way to the stadium, the path was lined with professors in their caps and gowns and doctoral sashes. They greeted graduates, smiling and congratulating them. Halfway to the stadium, I received one of the most memorable honors of my life. Just ahead of me, I saw two different deans on opposite sides of the path break out of the greeting line and approach me. With handshakes and hugs, the two sons of the mayor congratulated me and thanked me for what I did to console them and help to save their father's life. To write about it, even now, brings tears to my eyes and fills me with loving compassion and gratitude. I will never forget that moment and many others like that for as long as I live. We can achieve so much simply by being positive, loving, and full of integrity.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
If you're just joining us, this is Warren Holloman, and you're listening to So What's Your Story? I'm here with guest storyteller Dr. Barry Rose on listener-sponsored, corporate-free, 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. If you're down in Galveston, you can catch us on 89.5, and in Livingston on 90.3. Barry, I love the story. As you said, it has a roller coaster of emotions. So there's scary stuff, there's tension. Then there's good news, then you say, well, maybe it's not real, and then it's bad news, and then there's good news again. And you're thrown into all kinds of new challenges for a young man in his 20s. There's conflict. You've got conflict with the surgeon, with the family, the inner conflict that you're feeling. The characters are so interesting, a timid med student, an overconfident surgeon, a worried family, a critically ill patient, and then, of course, there's the surprise ending. And then there's a surprise ending after that, is the graduation. There's just kind of an extra. It's just from a narrative standpoint, it's a great story. But I'm thinking it's also a good teaching story for all of us, especially for doctors, nurses, patients, and families. And I was wondering, what did you learn from that experience that helped you be a better physician?
Well, I did learn that I didn't want to be a heart surgeon. You know, what I learned was the way you treat others dramatically affects the result. Mm-hmm. And if you lose your cool, if you don't come from a place of integrity, everybody else in the room is anxious and uptight, and the patient is going to get the bad end of the deal.
Yeah.
So it's so important to come from a place of care and compassion, control your emotions, and give the patient their best shot, and treat everybody else that's on the team with respect, because they're just as important, really, as you are.
I know I've often heard you say, and I read in your book, that you can sometimes learn as much from I think your wife first said it, you can learn as much from a negative experience as a positive one.
Right, from somebody's, you can learn just as much from somebody's bad behavior as from somebody's good behavior.
And I think you did. So.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, thanks. You've shared your experience as a medical student and as a physician. Barry, I was thinking, you're not unlike William Hurt in the award-winning role in the film The Doctor, which was based on a true story about a man who was a doctor, a surgeon, to be more specific, who became a patient, and a patient in great crisis when he was diagnosed with cancer in his neck area. I believe in his, I'll let you tell us.
Vocal cords.
Vocal cords, that's it, vocal cords. Now, you yourself are a cancer patient, and I'm guessing, like William Hurt's character, the experience must have been profound. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, Warren, it was profound. It was, I'm a guy that's never been sick. He's had some surgery for sports injuries. Basically thought I was invincible. And back around Thanksgiving of this last year, noticed that I had an enlarged lymph node in my neck. Turned out that after it was watched and then biopsied once, which showed inflammation, and then watched again for 2 or 3 months, and I finally asked some of my associates to remove it. They went ahead and biopsied it one more time, and it turned out to be a localized cancer in the lymph node. And the treatment was not surgery. It was radical radiation and chemotherapy to my neck.
At the same time.
At the same time. And described by the oncologist as probably the worst treatment for cancer. So I went from being fine, never had any pain or discomfort, to facing something I never thought I'd or dreamed I'd have to. My wife and I, we got diagnosed on a Tuesday. On Friday, we're getting a PET scan where they inject you with some radioactive marker to find out if it's just localized or if it's spread all through your body. And we ended up going to the PET scan, my wife and I together. And before they injected me, they brought in this lead-lined container with this radioactive material they're going to inject to me. And right as they were going to inject it, I looked at my wife and she looked at me, and we absolutely both broke down. I mean, we were in shock as it was. And after that, we both lost it. And then you have to wait an hour, and I had to sit for that hour wondering if I was going to find out that I had a localized thing that was curable, or I was going to have big time problems that I may not be able to get past. I already knew that I was going to have radical treatment. They were going to have to put a feeding tube in. Luckily, the PET scan only showed uptake in the lymph node, so very quickly after that, I started this treatment. I'm telling the story because of the importance of somebody there for you to advocate. My wife doesn't believe a lot in Western medicine. She is really more of a integrative Eastern medicine believer, with acupuncture and meditation and herbalists and healers. And so I ended up starting Western treatment, but throughout the process, which was extremely difficult, she was there with me every step of the way. She went to every treatment. She went to me every time I had to get radiation, which was 5 days a week for 7 weeks for 35 treatments to my neck. She was there to make sure I was fed. She found every healer I could imagine to work with me also. I meditated with her. We set up a little altar next to my bed so that I could at least sit and pray. It was something that I'd never even dreamed of experienced yet. There was a comfort from the love and the care that I got and knowing that she was there for me and trying to find any other way for me to get well. The treatment was something I'd never dreamed existed. And a lot of my care was disjointed along the way. There were people that had differing opinions, that did different things. And that was really eye-opening for me as a physician. I knew it existed. I knew we have a disconnect in some of our health care. And this was really something when I could experience it firsthand. And it really made me much more aware of the need for somebody to help you navigate the system when you're not well. A patient navigator, an advocate, your wife, a friend, anyone. And what patients need to do to advocate for themselves. In the end, I found out that with my treatment, probably 90% of the people have to take a break. They can't finish treatment because it's just too hard. And I actually had to completely use my feeding tube for 2.5 weeks that I had placed at the beginning just because I actually couldn't take in nourishment because it was too painful. But I've got through it. And I lost maybe 15 pounds instead of 30 or 40 that some people lose. And in the end, when I look back at it, the question was, I probably finished in the top 10% of the people that went through the treatment. Now, was it because I was a tough guy? Probably not. Was it because, not that I'm not a tough guy, but was it because that I had this incredible woman, my wife, Rose, advocating for me? Absolutely. And she found a lot of other alternative therapy, a lot of alternative healers that I did go to. And I went to energy healers, I went to acupuncturists, I went to herbalists, nutritionists, and I ended up ahead of the pack. And I got to think that it had to do with staying positive, having the support all through the process from my wife and other health professionals that were at least dedicated, and using alternative treatments too. So that needs to be available for everyone. And I'm now on the bandwagon for patient advocacy and maybe a universal type of training so everybody has the ability to have that kind of care.
For those who are just joining us, you're enjoying guest storyteller Barry Rose, Dr. Barry Rose, on So What's Your Story on 90.1 KPFT Houston. Barry, that story speaks to me on all kinds of levels. I think we all kind of blindly go through life assuming we're always going to be healthy. And knowing you, I mean, you were the paragon of health. You're a guy who I know would run just about every day.
Yes.
Does something I could not imagine doing. He jumps out of helicopters to go skiing down mountains. And then suddenly you're as sick as a person can be and still be alive. I mean, that must have just, and being a doctor on top of that, taking care of other people, that must have been a total shock.
It was definitely a shock. And I wasn't sick when it started. I was sick from the treatment, which was even wilder.
Yeah. Oh, the illness was not
the treatment was, I had no symptoms other than feeling a lymph node that wasn't, you know, normal. So it was a wild roller coaster experience, but I'm cancer free. My PET scan's clear, and I beat it. And for this disease, it has close to 100% chance for a total cure. And now I'm going to use it to help others.
Wow. That's good news. Very good news. I can't get over the irony of you're a physician. You're in the top 1% of the top 1% of being on the inside of the healthcare system. And yet, even you had trouble navigating this system. And then the other irony, your wife, who's not a physician, was the one who really navigated it for you in so many ways. That story has a lot of irony in it and says something about our healthcare system, unfortunately.
Well, it's time for changing things back to the way they should be and improving the situation in our healthcare system. And so it doesn't happen until you start a dialogue and you get patients and physicians working together to make it happen. So it's my way of saying it's time.
Yeah.
And it was aha. And the light went on, and I'm going to follow that as well as I can to try to make some changes.
And the book is The Cutting Edge of Compassion.
Yes.
And the best way to get it is?
You can go to my website, which is drbarryrose.com, mm-hmm. or you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's or almost any of the bookstores.
Well, Barry, I've enjoyed our conversation. I've enjoyed your stories. I'm glad both stories had happy endings. And I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed hearing you as well. Thanks so much for being on the show.
You bet. Thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Supporting our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a great way to develop your own skills in storytelling. Zoom on in to our monthly story swaps the fourth Tuesday of every month by accessing the link on our website, HoustonStorytellers.org. Our next swap is March 23rd from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And while you're on the site, why not become a member? Also, please visit our So What's Your Story Facebook page for guest and program information. And if you have ideas for a show or a guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org. Also, the Tejas Storytelling Festival is coming up, March 11th to 14th. So think about registering and becoming a member there too, to take your skills to the next level. Our friends at The Moth are still not packing into the warehouse live, but they are online at themoth.org. So enjoy all they have to offer. And also tune in to So What's Your Story each and every week, for we are the original storytelling platform in Houston.
I'm excited to tell you about tonight's guest, Dr. Michael Schaefer. He had the good fortune of enjoying a seemingly idyllic youth in the small town of Norton, Kansas, where his father managed a grain elevator. Then Michael broke free from his small town roots and went to Germany, Paris, and Chicago for his post-medical school training in plastic surgery. He practiced pediatric plastic surgery in Chicago for 30 years. And throughout his years of practice, Michael also volunteered his time doing overseas medical missions while raising three children who have provided him and his wonderful wife, Ellen, with six grandchildren. Michael's been a volunteer at KPFT, which is one of my favorite kind of people. And just while talking to him, I realized that he has a lifetime of powerful stories that I thought our audience would be as captivated as I have been. So, Michael Schaefer, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Well, thank you very much, Greg. This is a real thrill for me to be to participate in your show, and especially in your new format. So I'm just so happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, absolutely. My biggest problem with having you on is I've heard so many wonderful stories for you. I wasn't sure how we were going to narrow it down to just two. So I'm looking forward to the ones you've selected for tonight. But I'm holding out hope that we might get you on again at a later date. You are my first guest in our new hour-long format. And it was nice to have a friend, you know, as I navigate this hour. But I have a feeling that this hour is going to fly by. You know, Michael, country singer Kenny Chesney said, "I grew up in a small town, and I grew up in a place where your whole world revolved around friends, family, school, church, and sports. And I'm wondering if what he says kind of smacks of Norton, Kansas.
Oh, Greg, I think he could have taken that line right out of the Norton playbook. He's been reading our paper because that's just exactly how I would describe how I grew up and the people and the places from which I've come.
Sounds like a mighty nice way to grow up.
It was a wonderful place to be from. When I was there, it was a nice place to be, and now I look back on it with nothing but fond memories. It was a good place to have my beginning.
Well, it seems to me that your hometown is the antithesis of 21st century Houston. And I know that you and Ellen chose to move here after you both retired. And I've got to ask, why Houston?
Well, there's the short answer would be Chicago winters. The longer answer would be Ellen grew up here. This was her home until she married somebody else and moved away. And then when we retired, we thought we should come back here where it's just so beautiful. She had friends here who have become my friends, and we just really, really enjoy living here, and it's a wonderful place to be right now.
Well, how has Houston treated you or surprised you?
Well, I feel like I had kind of an introduction to the city and the culture through Ellen. She still has many friends here with whom she went to school and who also have moved away and come back, some of them. They have now become my friends. So I had this little coterie of friends within just a very short while of our being here. We came here periodically when Ellen's mother was still alive, so we'd come for a few weeks or a couple of months at a time, and so we kind of got used to it and then decided about a year ago to make this our full-time home, and I just love it. I love being here, and I love the people that I've met, and, you know, I've spent the last 50 years in another big city, so being in a big city is not that strange to me.
Well, I can say that Houston, KPFT, and even Floyd the Wonder Dog are better off for it. Floyd and Michael have become very good friends in the time they've been here. I want to thank you for sort of placing the image of your hometown in our mind. And with all that wonder, happiness, and family, while it sounds idyllic, your first story is about something quite different and even quite difficult. Would you tell us about it?
Surely. I'll be glad to, Greg. I've entitled this No Tears in Norton. And you'll see why as we go through this. It began as an ordinary day in my hometown, Norton, Kansas, a little town of 4,000 people on the edge of the prairie where time stands still and not much changes from one generation to the next. It's a town where restaurants are judged by the number of different kinds of Jell-O salad at the salad bar, and hors d'oeuvres at a successful dinner party are cubes of minced ham and Velveeta cheese skewered on a toothpick. And, of course, swirls of cheese whiz on a Ritz cracker with a slice of pimento olive on top. It's a bustling little town. With good schools and good athletic teams, it was mostly a happy town. That is, it was a happy town till tragedy struck one day. Tragedy the likes of which the people there had never experienced before, nor have they since. It shook the town of Norton, Kansas, to its very core. Three men died that day in a grain elevator accident. Gene Schaefer and Paul Stutterheim had been partners down at the Ralph Rich Grain Company for about 35 years. They were both just getting ready to retire and had turned the management of this country elevator and grain business over to Paul's son, Don Stutterheim. However, both Paul Stutterheim and Gene Schaefer continued to come down to the elevator almost every day, mostly because they just couldn't quite let go, couldn't stop doing what they had been doing for all those years. They came and sat and talked to the old friends and chatted with customers. I think they also wanted to kind of keep an eye on things to make sure they stayed running like they should. Leo Dirks had been in that morning to settle up for his wheat harvest. And Tom Melroy was just pulling out in his big rig, loaded with livestock feed of rolled oats and molasses to feed his cattle. In fact, Tom had gotten the last of the molasses stored in the pit where it was kept to be mixed with the grain as it tumbled down into the chute and was augured up into the waiting truck. Don Stutterheim was out in the driveway of the elevator that morning making his rounds to see that everything was working as it should. There were three workmen, all doing various chores around the place. Harold Wiltfong had been there the longest, probably 25 years or so, and was the senior man of the group, also the one who could talk the most and the longest while leaning up against a customer's pickup truck, all the while with a toothpick or a wooden matchstick dangling from the corner of his mouth. Daryl Kieswetter and Phil Pogue had each worked there 10 or 12 years, and each knew his way around the place, and they were the best of friends. After the last load of rolled oats and molasses was finished, Phil Pogue looked down into the molasses pit and saw it was completely empty. He decided to go down into the pit and sweep it all out before pouring in the next batch of that sticky, sweet-smelling brown liquid that the livestock loved so much and made them eat more grain so as to fatten them up for market. Phil grabbed a broom and climbed down the iron-runged ladder into the depths of that molasses pit. Several minutes went by, and Daryl Kieswetter realized he hadn't heard a sound since Phil had climbed down into the pit. He looked down and saw his friend slumped motionless on the floor. Without thinking, he then slid down the ladder to help his friend. He did not come back up either. Now, Don Stutterheim, the young manager, was nearby and must have sensed that something was wrong. Both men had disappeared, and there had been no sound. Don looked into the hole and realized what was happening. He saw both his men on the floor of the pit. He gave a blood-curdling cry for help and slid down the ladder himself to try to rescue his men. Don didn't come back up either. The volunteer fire department was called, and they came with their oxygen tanks and went down into the molasses pit and hauled out the three men one by one. All those men were known by everybody in town, and especially Don. He was young and had a little family, and he was truly loved by everybody. He had indeed died a hero's death, for he surely knew what was happening, and even so, plunged down that hole to try to rescue his men. These men died not from poison gas or a toxic residue from the molasses, but rather from the total lack of oxygen in the depth of that pit. The volume of liquid matter that had been in there had forced out all the air from the space, and with only a small manhole at the top, there had been no replenishing of the normal air with its normal amount of oxygen into that space. In an atmosphere totally devoid of oxygen, a man can live only a fraction of a second and then dies immediately. These men had died such a death, painless, but awful and sad nonetheless. The following Saturday, there were three funerals in Norton, two at the Enfield Funeral Home and one at the Methodist Church. Pretty much everybody in the county attended all of them, and pretty much the same things were said at each of them. Pretty much the same songs were sung, including The Old Rugged Cross and Amazing Grace, and pretty much everybody cried. By the end of that day, there was not a tear left in my hometown of Norton, Kansas.
Well, what a horrifying, horrifying tragedy. And yet what a beautiful telling of it. I have to ask, this was in the mid-1970s, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Do you know why there were no alarms or monitoring equipment to let them know what was going on?
Greg, this was such an unusual incident. You know, it's well known there are other types of elevator accidents, such as elevator dust. Grain dust can ignite spontaneously and
see,
cause
I've heard
fires
of that throughout my life, but yeah. I've never heard of this.
Well, nobody in town had heard of it before, and of course everybody knows about it now, but first of all, it's an isolated community way out in a little town out in nowhere practically. And everybody was very careful, like all, you know, farming and farm-related industries cause or are related to probably more accidents and serious injuries than almost anything short of war and those kinds of things. But it had just never been heard of before, and it just you know, wasn't something that anybody really thought about. So when this happened, of course, it's now becomes well known, but it just simply wasn't on anybody's radar screen.
And was this the same grain elevator company that your father had managed?
Yes, uh-huh.
Was he still living when this happened?
Oh, yes. In fact, he was there. He and his partner, as I mentioned, they went every day, and this, they had turned the management over to my dad's partner's son, who was my age, Don. We'd grown up together, and I had aspirations to to leave Norton, and Don was quite happy to be there, so he took over the management of the elevator. So both his dad and my dad were there that day, and they're the ones that called for help from the volunteer fire department.
Wow. What would you like our audience to take from this story?
Well, several things, I think. One is that it kind of shows that we're sort of all in this together.
Amen.
We live in our own little worlds thinking that these kinds of things usually happen to somebody else or to some place far away. And here was a simple little town, a simple community, and on the great scheme of things, this incident was not very major in scale. It certainly, if it happens to you, it's 100%.
Right.
But we hear of tragedies going around the world, and 30 or 40 years ago as well. But when it strikes in your family or your home, it takes on a new meaning. And so the fact that something like this could come into a town that's pretty serene and pretty, as I said in my introduction, kind of a happy town, these things wake you up and lets everybody realize that disaster can strike at any moment. And we think when we go to work each morning or start our day expecting to come home that evening and to our loved ones or ourselves or to Wonder Dog Floyd. And in just an instant, that can change, and we don't.
Well, it's certainly a reminder to err on the side of doing that last kind deed, saying that last kind word, and not putting it off for another day, because we really don't know that another day or another hour will be here.
Amen to that. I agree completely.
Now, Michael, your next story takes place about the same time as your first story, but in very different places. I think it tells us a bit about why someone would go into pediatric plastic surgery, which to me seems like an extremely daunting profession, both because of skill and the emotion it must pull out of you. But would you be willing to share your second story with us?
Greg, I'd be happy to. And I say that because this story is really about somebody else, and I just happen to be a lucky player in this drama, a co-journeyer with this young woman. The story is about a young Greek girl, Konstantina Triantafylidis, who came into my life when she was about 7 years old. But the incident that started all of this happened when she was 22 months old. She lived with her mother and father and an older sister, a grandmother and a great-grandmother in Heraklion, Crete, Greece. And one day the mother was at work, the grandmother was outside in the yard, and the great-grandmother was sort of tending Dina, who was not quite 2 years old, and the kerosene heater tipped over, caught the rug on fire, the carpet, and then caught the great-grandmother's clothing on fire. And burned the house down. And the little girl was in one of those old-fashioned iron baby beds, which heated immediately. And her fingers became fused to the iron railings, and she couldn't get them off, and people couldn't get them off immediately. Anyway, she was badly burned on her hands and her face. The rest of her body was spared of the burn. The great-grandmother ultimately died from her injuries. And from that point on, Dina and her burn injuries became the focus of that family's life. They moved to Athens, and this child underwent, we think, 30 or 35 surgical procedures over the next 5 or 6 years in Athens. And they did the best they could with limited facilities and limited resources. But they were doing mostly little pinch grafts from spots on her body, trying to resurface the burned area on her face. And so finally they told the parents that that was all they could do. During this time, her father was working double shifts at a flour mill, carrying 100-pound feed sacks or flour sacks in and out of the mill for an 8-hour shift and then another 8-hour shift to help pay for this child's medical expenses. When they were told that nothing more could be done in Athens, the mother then went to all of the embassies in Athens, the foreign embassies, asking them, please, would they take their her child to whatever country that was, respectively, and perhaps they could do something more for her. These included the Russian embassy, the Romanian embassy, French, British, and none of them either would or could oblige her. She then took the little girl to bars around town and had the child dance on the bar top to raise some money to help them with their expenses for her medical care. Chicago, as you may or may not know, is the second largest Greek city in the world, second only after Athens, and is ahead of Salonika. There's a large Greek community there, and they finally got word of this little girl and her family. And there's a wonderful media guru, Bobby Papadimos was his name. He owned a TV and radio station. And he heard about Dina and her family and got the Greek community together, and they raised over $40,000. And with that money, they brought Dina and her father to Chicago. For the first year, it was just she and the father. And then about a year later, the mother and the sister were able to come and join them. I had spent a year and a half in Greece in the Air Force. I was a partially trained general surgeon in the U.S. Air Force and just loved my year and a half in Greece, and so maintained my contacts with the Greek community when I got back to Chicago. So through that contact and the fact that I was a new staff member on the Children's Memorial Hospital, the spokespeople for that Greek community got in touch with me and asked if I would be willing to see this girl and give them my opinion. And I also had an older, much more experienced senior partner who would be part of that for a while. So that became the starting point for us. We saw the girl and met initially her father. Unfortunately, he spoke a very little limited English, and I was able to get along on the Greek that I'd learned during my time in Greece. So we had this wonderful relationship, an immediate rapport. Dina was exactly the same age as my older girl. They were born in March of 1969. So she was 7 when they came to the States. We actually did her first operation on her 8th birthday. And so from that time on, their family became very closely intermeshed with mine, and my kids played with Dina and her sister, her parents, and my wife and I became good friends. Over the next 20 years then, I operated on this child probably, it's not quite sure, 35 or 40 times. Sometimes we would do 2 or 3 surgeries in quick succession. Other times we would spread them out, let things heal and settle down for 6 months or perhaps a year. In plastic surgery, the essence of really good healing and a good result is just being patient and allowing Mother Nature to help and take her time with the healing that must go on. One of the reasons I'm so happy to tell this story, and it has nothing to do with my part in it, this child had the most indomitable spirit, and her mother had the most indomitable drive to seek everything possible for this child. Never in any of our experiences did the child say no, she wasn't going to do that, she wasn't going to have another surgery. The mother was just always there. Michael, isn't there something more we can do? Michael, isn't there something more that I could do to help? So we kept going, and even when I was down or when I felt that the procedure had been less than optimal, they buoyed me up and said, Dr. Schaefer or the mother would say, Michael, that's all right. We'll have another chance. It's not going to be perfect every time. And so over the course of some years, we totally resurfaced her face, making it much more smooth and kind of divided up into segments. We resurfaced her entire forehead, both cheeks, the chin, the upper lip, reconstructed her nose, and then separated the fingers that had been mostly amputated from the second knuckle on out. So it's called the distal part of her fingers, that is the toward the tip of all 10 of her, 8 of her fingers and 2 thumbs had been burned away or had been amputated surgically in the early stages. So we, while we were waiting for things to settle down and heal on the face, we were doing a little operation on the hands to separate some of the fingers so that we could make them more mobile, and they were more, made her hands more functional. She couldn't even hold her own eating utensils when we first met, when this first started. So the other little sidebar here is that during this period of time, my family was remodeling an old house in Chicago. And so her father would come over on the weekends when he was off from his regular job and help me do the heavy work, the heavy lifting at our home. And believe me, there was some really dirty, heavy work. But he was such a professional laborer. He had made a profession of just doing hard work. And he could make the toughest job look easy, the dirtiest job look, he would come away from it not getting dirty, doing a dirty job. And Stavros was just a wonderful guy, very trim and very fit. But he unfortunately developed heart disease and died when Dina was in high school. Well, in college, she did go away to school. A wonderful Greek man paid her way through a private high school in Chicago, in the suburb of Chicago, and then on through college. And so in the summertime, she would come and work for me in my office. And I thought, you know, I'm very generous in spirit with these sorts of things. But I have to confess, I thought, you know, she's really still, as much as we've done for her, she's pretty still deformed. And is this going to be good PR for me to have somebody looking this deformed in my plastic surgery office? Well, it took me about 2 seconds to get over that thought, because I thought, you know, with all the work that I've done for her, if she can't work in my office, if I can't have her be in my environment, who in the world is going to? And so, you know, I didn't dwell on that thought very long. She's a wonderful, wonderful young woman. So I think she was between her sophomore and junior, maybe junior and senior year in the summertime. I said, Dana, we have just a couple more things to do. And she said, well, Dr. Schaefer, what is that? I'm pretty happy. And I said, well, the fourth and fifth finger on your left hand are still sort of scarred together. I think we should separate them. You might want to put a ring on that fourth finger one day. And she just laughed. She said, oh, Dr. Schaefer, you're just being silly. That's never going to happen to me. Nobody would really want me. I said, Dina, you're going to be wonderful for somebody someday. So she went back to school that year, and some months went by, and she called, and she said, well, Dr. Schaefer, it's happened. Christopher's asked me to marry him, and I have a ring on that finger. So I didn't say I told you so, but I said, Dina, I am thrilled for you, because somehow I sensed that there would be somebody out there who would appreciate the value for what you are. And she said, well, that's exactly what he said. He said he could see past my scars and my deformities, and he just loves me the way I am. And then she said, I have one other favor to ask of you, since you know my dad's died. The wedding's going to be next September. Will you walk down the aisle with me and give me away? Wow. So, when I got my voice back, kind of like right now, I said, sure, of course I would. There's nothing I would rather do. So Ellen and I went to Lexington, Massachusetts that September and helped celebrate in what was one of the most wonderful celebrations of happiness and love and joy that we've ever been part of.
Wow, what a wonderful story, Michael. You have taken us on a roller coaster of emotions in a few minutes. I was tearing up thinking about that poor 22-month-old girl basically being burned alive, and then I was smiling from ear to ear as I pictured you walking that same young woman down the aisle and making a part for her in your community and your family and your office, and thinking about what it said about you as the type of doctor and type of man you are. And I'm not going to put you on the spot, so you don't have to answer that. It just does. What goes through your head? Now, I have the advantage of looking at your face, and I have an idea of what's going through your head. But tell our audience what goes through your head while you're telling this amazing story.
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is gratitude. I have been so fortunate to have been able to do in my professional life what I've done. I did something called craniofacial surgery much of my professional years, and I had the opportunity to work with many children, much like Dina, but not to the same extent of getting to be intimate friends with the family, and their deformities were much more of birth defect nature, not burns in origin. But I have been fortunate. I've been blessed to be able to do this sort of thing. And as I tell people who tell me this, you know, you just read a couple books and go to a weekend seminar and you can do what I did. But
I have a feeling that's not true.
But it was just such a treat to work with children and families like Dina and her family. I tell you, I came away the richer for every encounter like that I ever had.
Well, this story is so moving that we were not the first to feature it. The December 6th, 1999 issue of People magazine featured the story of you and Dina, along with pictures of you walking her down the aisle. And we will be sure to post those pictures to our Facebook page if any of our audience would like to check them out, because I've certainly been kind of glued to them as we've prepared this show. I keep calling Michael with questions because, you know, morning, noon, and night, I think of new aspects of this powerful story.
Well, friends, as with all good stories, we've come to the end of ours tonight. But I want to thank you for spending part of your pandemic with us. I hope you'll spend part of your downtime sharing your own stories and encourage those you are sheltering with to tell their own. While it's a difficult and challenging time for everyone, telling and hearing good stories is a much better option than one more evening of Netflix. Don't you dare move, friends, because Lars and the Tennyson Tapes will be right up, where Lars shares a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
It's time for the Dove to retire and time for a brand new look for KPFT. KPFT needs a new logo, and we want you in the KPFT community to design it for Houston's community station. We're putting on a logo design contest and asking you to submit your ideas for a new logo for KPFT. All the info you need, including contest rules, a website for uploading your submissions, can be found at kpft.org. We'll be accepting logo design submissions through March 1st. And then the funnest part begins. Starting at 12:01 p.m. on March 1st, the community gets to vote on their favorite designs. Voting ends at 11:59 on March 5th. The top five vote getters will constitute the pool of designs from which the winner will be chosen, and the winning design and designer will be revealed on the air and on the internet March 8th. Visit kpft.org for all the details. We cannot wait to see what kind of artistic genius lives in our community. So get your designs together and get them in before March 1st. Help us design a brand new look for Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1, Houston.
Whether it's the memories of great songs or the up-to-the-minute news and talk you've come to depend on, KPFT means something to you. It means something to our volunteers, too. They've decided to dedicate some of their time off to helping the station that's helped them. Volunteering at KPFT is more than just contributing time. It's about being part of something special, unique, exciting. Independent radio in a city where non-commercial